From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. Women on all sides of the abortion debate are preparing for the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade. The leaked draft opinion suggests the court is preparing to overturn decades of abortion rights. But amid the political disagreements, there are competing claims about what women really want. At the center of this debate are Black and Hispanic women who would be disproportionately impacted by the overturning of Roe. Gloria Purvis has been thinking about these issues. She hosts the Gloria Purvis podcast, and she opposes abortion rights. Welcome, Gloria.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Supreme Court leaked draft opinion is just a draft, but in it, Justice Samuel Alito says Roe v. Wade must be overruled. What was your reaction when you saw that this decision may be overturned?
Well, initially, I was like, this is a lie. There's no way this is true. And then when the public affairs office of the Supreme Court verified it, I started to dream of what a better world could be for women, a world that actually accepts us completely as we are. I'm thinking we have a chance to renegotiate the whole social compact for women.
I'll ask you more about that, but you have said that Black women are used as a mascot for why Roe v. Wade should not be overturned. What did you mean by that?
Well, if you think about it all the time, it's talking about Black women, Black women, Black women, you know, ooh, the poor, poor Black woman is going to be negatively impacted if she doesn't have access to abortion. And when you actually talk to poor Black women, if you're out there, abortion is not the first thing these poor Black women say they want. They want affordable housing. They want good education for their children. They want job training. Abortion is not their top priority. And so I'm thinking, why don't we provide these poor Black women what they actually want and need so that they can thrive and flourish?
Well, let me follow up with that, because according to the pro-abortion rights Guttmacher Institute in the United States, the abortion rate for Black women is almost five times that for white women. Black and Hispanic women have nearly 60% of abortions in the United States. And Guttmacher points to some possible causes: the disproportionately high number of unintended pregnancies among these women, less access to birth control, and some women who are just trying to get by don't have the luxury to plan out birth control. So if the goal is to reduce the number of abortions, why not focus on getting these women better access to birth control?
I would say if you look at why women are choosing not to have children in those circumstances, it is because of their material needs aren't being met. And frankly, I think we have an attitude that poor women, poor Black women, should not have children. There's a lot of stigma to be unmarried and have children. And I think we need to have a wholesale change in our attitude and approach to actually be welcoming and accepting of women who are struggling and pregnant, rather than, you know, really acting as if this is a problem and a terrible, irresponsible thing.
But what about the women who don't have insurance and they face enormous costs for prenatal care and infant care? What about the fact that there is no federal paid family leave?
That's a
problem. How can you support getting rid of abortion access before women have these support structures in place?
Oh, because I think abortion upholds the very systems that oppress women. I think that's the problem. I think abortion has actually taught society negatively about women and pregnancy. Something is natural to us. And if I believe it's unjust, I don't need everything else to be perfect for me to say an unjust system has to go. But I am going to say, at the same time, I'm also calling on everybody, especially people listening, do something to help the women in the community. Don't make it about, well, you go and get that abortion. Do the harder thing. Love them. Get involved. Have some compassion. Advocate for them to get the things that they need.
So you believe there needs to be a sea change in thinking
Absolutely.
About women and children, flexible work, paid maternity leave, health care,
yes.
and abortion numbers would go down? I mean, what is the realignment that you envision in a post-Roe world?
In a post-Roe world, I envision a place where abortion is unthinkable, where women are fully at all stages of our life, welcomed in society. And in fact, I think we need to, instead of trying to make us into the perfect male worker, and that means us being unencumbered by our caregiving responsibilities because we can get pregnant and have children, I think men need to be encumbered to the women and children that they help create. We need a complete changing of how we think about things, because sex is asymmetrical for men and women. And I think men have been allowed to walk away. And then it's been put to us like, well, for you to be free, you need to walk away and be unencumbered, just like men are. And I think that's, at its very core, very anti-woman, because that's just not how we are made.
So if Roe is overturned, many expect that there will be an increase in so-called back alley abortions. Before Roe, there were women who died because of unsafe abortions. Does it concern you that we could go back to those days?
I think it's a myth that abortion is widely safe in the first place. It's not without its risks physically and psychologically.
But would you agree abortion also saves women's lives?
No, absolutely not. I do not believe that anything that goes against the nature of who we are as women, and pregnancy and giving birth is a part of the female nature. I don't believe that anything that goes against our nature in such a violent way really saves a woman's life.
So what is the culture of life as you define it post-Roe to your mind? What do you envision?
Oh, what I envision is just everything in society, from high school, colleges, making way for women who are pregnant and mothering, flexibility in classes, flexibility in work schedules, just a dream. Imagine all the things that we could do differently if we focused on making women a part of the economy in a way that does not ask them to do something violent to who they naturally are, that we make way for when we just need to rethink the whole scheme, how we work, how we play, how we rest, everything, I think just needs to be rethought. And I'm hoping that myself and plenty of other women who, whether they support abortion or not, will get together and start to dream and make those demands on society. We deserve it.
Gloria Purvis hosts the Gloria Purvis podcast. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jane.
And this note, doctors say that abortions are safe and are sometimes necessary to save a woman's life. And also that an abortion ban would create unnecessary health risks for women.
The new infrastructure law gives states $7.5 billion to build charging stations for electric cars. But Wyoming's share of that isn't that much when you consider the state covers a lot of territory and distances between towns are long. Wyoming Public Media's Taylor Stagner reports.
A rusty blue Ford Bronco pulls into a gas station and tire shop in central Wyoming, one of several Mike Bailey's family has owned since the 60s. Bailey could apply for federal funding to add electric car chargers, but he's not sure he will.
Sometimes those technologies work out, and sometimes they don't. So, you know, we'll see.
The bill is sending Wyoming $25 million to install electric car chargers, but unlike some other states, its Department of Transportation isn't planning to do that work itself. It's leaving it up to private industry to apply for the money and do the work. Wyoming's economy has been based on fossil fuels for more than a century, and many people here would like it to stay that way. And Bailey says the federal grants don't cover the full cost.
You can spend $500,000 pretty easy on that. So even if they pay for 80% of that, that's still $100,000 that you've got to show that you could make that return on your investment over time.
Adam Davis is a researcher at the University of California, Davis. He says Wyoming is already way behind the rest of the country when it comes to publicly available electric vehicle chargers.
Wyoming is probably somewhere on the lines of like 1/10 as far along as California, which is the fastest state in the country, and something like a third to half as far along as the rest of the country, the sort of national average.
A big reason is that Wyoming has the lowest population of any U.S. state, with fewer than 600,000 people. Since many rely on the energy industry for their paychecks, people here can be hostile to alternative energy. The Wyoming Department of Transportation says that there are only 500 electric vehicles in the whole state.
You need chargers to support electric vehicles. But if you don't have electric vehicles, then the chargers don't make sense. And getting those things balanced is really, really, really tricky.
But there's at least one guy in Wyoming who's determined to get more electric cars on the road, Patrick Lawson. He says he's been into electric cars since way before the first Tesla rolled out.
When I was really little, like 6 years old, I put together a little car out of two solar panels and electric motors and made it so that I could make it change directions by putting my hand over it.
Lawson, who's Northern Arapaho, works for his tribe's internet company. His side hustle is Wild West EV, a business he started that's installing chargers in central Wyoming. He lives in Riverton and sees progress in electric car adoption.
And I've found quite a few people in town, actually, who've got them now over the years. So there's, I don't know, maybe a dozen of us or so, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it went from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8. And if you look at the numbers nationally, the EVs have almost doubled in sales every year for the past 10 years.
Lawson started his business in 2016. So far, he's helped businesses set up chargers in 5 Wyoming towns. He's working on applications for the federal funding to help set up more and expects to start submitting them this summer. For NPR News, I'm Taylor Stagner in Riverton, Wyoming.
We don't have to tell you there's a lot going on right now in the world. The Supreme Court is likely to overturn Roe v. Wade. Many states are limiting rights for transgender youth. And Florida now bans grade school teachers from teaching about sexual orientation or gender identity. A lot of cultural change to parse. And, you know, shows like this, the news media, social media may not give enough context for this moment. Perhaps you need a book. Tracy Thomas is creator and host of the podcast The Stacks, and she's here with some selections. Tracy, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for inviting me back.
Okay, topping your list is the book Allow Me to Retort. I love the title, a book by Elie Mystel, and he writes for The Nation magazine. For a book on the Supreme Court, why do you like this one?
So what I love about this book is that Elie Mystel is also on CNN and MSNBC. And if you've seen him there, you know he's funny. He's very clear, very approachable, is talking about the Constitution, is talking about the Supreme Court in a way that I, a total non-Supreme Court junkie, can understand. Yeah. And that's true in this book as well. He's talking about how we can understand the Constitution, how we can think about our rights and the politics that have been inserted into the Constitution and into the Supreme Court. Elie Mystel is talking about what that looks like, how we can fight against that, and in a way that we can all sort of understand and grapple with.
Okay, speaking of the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade, he expected overturning it. If and when it comes, it would be one of the biggest rulings in a generation. We know that. You are recommending Mary Ziegler's After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. What is the lost history in this case?
So the book came out in 2015, which was a little over 40 years after the Roe versus Wade decision. And what Mary is figuring out and talking about or sharing with us in the book is how the debate wasn't always what it is now. It wasn't always pro-choice versus pro-life. It was actually, you know, framed as pro-abortion versus anti-abortion. The two sides were actually working together to try to find common ground. And over the last almost 50 years, that has clearly shifted. And some of that also hidden history that she talks about is that it wasn't always about just a woman's right to choose. It wasn't always anti-feminist, and there was a lot more nuance in the conversation, which she explores in great detail.
Okay, so let's move on to a maybe not so obvious choice, the book Killing the Black Body by Dorothy Roberts. What does that bring to this public conversation we're having on abortion?
I think that so often white women's voices are the most amplified when it comes to this debate about abortion. And in Killing the Black Body, Dorothy Roberts, this book's from 1997, she talks about all the different systemic injustices and harm that have been done to black women and the way that the media covers black women, like myths on welfare queens and crack babies, and then also the actual things that have been done, like obviously slavery, forced sterilization. And so it sort of lines this up in the context of American history for black women. And we know that the people who will suffer most if Roe is in fact overturned are women who are less wealthy, who do not have access to travel. And oftentimes that includes black and brown women, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And this book also puts that into context.
Okay. Let's turn to the topic of transgender youth. A lot of changes for them in certain state capitals. Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution by Susan Stryker. It sounds like it might be a good starting point for a long view on how we got to here.
Yeah, I think it is a great place to start. It will detail the transgender history in the U.S. from the mid-20th century until today. The book came out in 2017, so not today, but, you know, recently. Mm-hmm. And it shows, you know, that transgender people have been here and have been organizing and creating community and activism for a long time. And so, again, it's putting these things that we're hearing about so much in 2022 in a greater context. You know, the stripping of rights of transgender children is new to today, but it is not new to the ways that transgender people have been harmed in this country. So I didn't know that there were communities in World War II of transgender, at the time they were called transvestite communities, but that they were organizing together post-World War II, and that there was a trans radicalism movement that started in the mid-1960s through the 70s. And so this book is giving much broader understanding of the work that trans activists have been doing for decades.
Yeah. Also, Tracy, you recommend Real Queer America by Samantha Allen. Why?
This book is phenomenal. It is a first-person sort of account. Samantha Allen is a transgender author, and they went out into the world and said, I want to go to red states and talk to other queer Americans. I think so often the idea that red states are full of people who hate everybody else, want to strip their rights, don't believe in abortion, don't believe in gay people, erases so many queer, trans people living in red states. And so Samantha Allen has gone there. The motto of the book is something gay every day. And Samantha goes to places like Utah, Indiana, throughout the Bible Belt, and finds these communities, finds these gay nights at the club and all of these things to really bring light to the fact that states may be red or blue when it comes to presidential elections, but that it's all much more mixed up than it seems on those maps.
And Tracy, before we go, book banning is back in America's public conversation after a Tennessee school district banned the graphic novel Mouse on grounds of objectionable language and nudity. Do you have a pick or two of frequently banned books to check out?
Yes.
I see Kite Runner's on your list.
I love Kite Runner. It's one of my favorite books. Khalid Hosseini has written just a magnificent book. But the book that I always suggest that people read on the book ban list is The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. One is because I think a lot of people say that they've read Toni Morrison, and I don't actually think that they have, which is fine. You can start today. Don't worry.
Yeah, yeah.
But also because The Bluest Eye gets at a lot of the things that we actually talked about earlier, which is Black women, girls in America and how they're treated and how they see themselves and how they feel in the world. And the idea that that is somehow worthy of ban or dangerous enrages me as a Black woman. But also, I think it needs to be interrogated. I think more people need to read the book and think about why someone would think it was dangerous.
We have been talking about some particularly timely books with Tracy Thomas. She's creator and host of the book podcast, The Stacks. And we'll have Tracy's entire list at our website, hereandnow.org. Tracy, great as always to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Elon Musk has been tweeting about his potential acquisition of Twitter today. But let's go to Brownsville, Texas, where one of his other companies, SpaceX, is expanding its facility to launch rockets. As Texas Public Radio's Gage Davila reports, some residents say the cost of housing is the only thing soaring out of this world.
The city of Brownsville has changed its motto from on the border by the sea to on the border by the sea and beyond. In downtown, there are space-themed murals, including one of an astronaut. It's on the side of a hot dog stand owned by Rebecca Rodriguez.
When I decided to get this business, I thought, you know what, I need to incorporate that into the business because I know that it's going to be hopping like the young kids say.
SpaceX is Brownsville's largest private employer and wants to expand their site on a popular undeveloped stretch of coastline just outside the city. That has upset some residents, along with rising house prices and rents. Christopher Basaldu, a Native American scholar from Brownsville, moved apartments as rent prices soared across the city last year. His previous landlord sold the building, and now he's paying more for a smaller place.
What SpaceX is doing is taking advantage of the long history of economic exploitation of human beings in this valley.
Basaldu is a member of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe of Texas. His ancestral lands stretch far along the Rio Grande River, separating Texas and Mexico, and onto the coast. Basaldu believes the city has fallen victim to SpaceX seeking short-term monetary gain. He sees parallels between his housing ordeal and the plight of his ancestors who were forced off this land by colonists.
That whole structure of inequality that makes life so difficult, that history is not lost on me.
A Texas A&M University study found housing prices increased nearly 30% in the last few years. Half of Brownsville's available houses have been sold since January 2019. Median family income for Brownsville residents is around $40,000. That's less than two-thirds of the national average. But the city's leaders are more focused on the economic promise SpaceX pitched. Brownsville Mayor Trey Mendez declined interview requests, but said in his 2021 State of the City address that SpaceX is a priority.
We're actively building a new space ecosystem in Brownsville to attract more space-related companies. New space is projected to be a trillion-dollar industry by 2030, and Brownsville will position itself as a city that welcomes this industry and fosters innovation.
The housing problem worsened when Elon Musk told his Twitter followers in 2021 to move to the area for SpaceX jobs. Nick Mitchell Bennett heads the affordable housing organization Come Dream, Come Build.
It's gone from 0 miles an hour to, you know, we're at breakneck speed right now.
But recently, Musk cast doubt over SpaceX's future in Brownsville. Musk's company is waiting for the Federal Aviation Administration to decide whether a lengthy environmental review is needed to expand. When asked about this in February, Musk said they may move the Mars launches across the Gulf if the review is ordered.
So we would have to shift our priorities to Cape Kennedy.
Musk's threat to shift their Starship plans to Florida would be a big departure from his initial promise of launching the first person to Mars from Brownsville. SpaceX did not respond to interview requests. One artist is channeling frustration with Musk and housing costs. Josue Ramirez's exhibit currently shows at a nearby college.
Arts and culture really is a shortcut to understanding policy, because that's ultimately what shapes it. People feel a different kind of way after they see these portraits, and maybe that will change into a public opinion once enough people see it.
Ramirez uses bandit signs with phrases like, "We buy houses." He paints silhouette portraits on some of them. One is of Musk, titled "Silhouette of a Gentrifier." For NPR News, I'm Gage Davila in Brownsville, Texas.
It's Friday the 13th, and the superstitious among us have another eerie omen to look forward to this weekend. On Friday night, a total lunar eclipse will summon up what's sometimes called a blood moon. Astronomers with a more empirical outlook say the moon will appear red-orange because of light filtering through Earth's atmosphere. Kelly Beatty is a senior editor at Sky and Telescope, and he's here to tell us more. Hi, Kelly.
Great to be back with you.
Well, it's been almost a year since the last total lunar eclipse, so refresh our memory. What's going to happen if we're lucky enough to be in the path of this eclipse?
Oh, it's great. And, you know, the thing about a lunar eclipse is that it's visible from a huge area. All of the half of the Earth that's facing the moon will get to see this. And what you're going to watch is the moon go from full, which it is this coming Sunday night, to basically black over the course of about an hour and a half.
And so tell us exactly, you say half of the Earth will see this. Where will it be visible and when?
The good news is that it'll be visible everywhere across the contiguous U.S. from the East Coast to the West Coast. The East Coast is favored a little bit. The event lasts about 3.5 hours from start to finish. But the real key time is 11:29 Eastern, that's 8:29 Pacific, on the evening of Sunday, when the total lunar eclipse will begin. That's when the moon will have slipped completely into the darkest part of Earth's shadow, called the umbra, and will have made this transition from a bright full moon to basically black. And it wouldn't be It would be completely black if we didn't have an atmosphere. We get a little light filtering through, and that's what colors the moon's surface this sort of dark orange, rusty color.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Eclipses are something that have really captivated humanity since, well, ancient history. Why do you think they're so awe-inspiring?
Well, for one thing, it's prior to, you know, our knowledge of how eclipses work, it was a very, as you mentioned, superstitious at the beginning of the broadcast here. It really spooked people out. They didn't know if the moon was going to be coming back or not. Christopher Columbus famously used a lunar eclipse to scare the indigenous peoples. I think it was on his third voyage. But I like it because it literally is showing the moon moving along in its orbit. We get to watch the clockwork of the solar system in action.
Hmm. All right, give us your best tips for eclipse viewing practices.
Okay, so the East Coast is favored. This is going to take place, you'll need to call it a late night. The middle of the eclipse is going to be about 12, a little bit after midnight. Moon's going to be high in the sky. Sky will get dark. Your stars will come out that wouldn't ordinarily be there. On the West Coast, especially on the far west, the eclipse will be underway once the sun sets and the moon pops up over the eastern horizon. But you'll get to see total eclipse too. And so what I want you to be alert to is no two eclipses are the same. Keep an eye out for changes in color as the moon passes through that shadow.
Okay, we'll start looking at 11:29 p.m. Eastern on Sunday night. I know a lot of people are excited about this one. Kelly Beatty is senior editor of Sky and Telescope. Thank you.
We have been asking you to share stories of teens and where they're finding joy. Medical leaders, including the Surgeon General, are warning parents that more American teenagers are depressed and suicidal. In the first half of last year, nearly 45% of high school students said they felt persistently sad or hopeless, according to the CDC. So, how are teens finding ways to thrive? Well, many of you told us exercise. Beth Rose of Louisville, Kentucky, tells us her 17-year-old son has gone through a lot of changes lately, including a new school, and soccer has been his escape. Thankful he is okay, she says. We share lots of love and conversations. Mary Kitchen and her family in Las Vegas have plunged into swimming. During COVID, she installed a pool for her three teenage daughters.
It has brought a lot of smiles just about daily to our family, so we've been really thankful for that.
And also pets, Kitchen says.
When we all went on lockdown, we adopted two dogs from a local rescue, and they have absolutely been a huge source of joy for our entire family and really helped to bring us together and center on a constantly needing activity.
That family activity is walking dogs and hanging out. Which brings us to Vinosh Fullan of Chesterfield, Virginia. He emailed that he discovered rowing in the early days of the pandemic, and we have him on the line now. Vin, welcome. Good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too.
So you're a ninth grader in high school, but take us back to the summer of 2020 when the pandemic first started and when you discovered rowing.
Well, that was the summer of my seventh grade year, and I kind of got a little stir crazy.
Yeah.
So my parents enrolled me in this summer camp for rowing. Honestly, I didn't love it at first. It's a very tiring sport. It's really intense mentally and physically. But over time, though, I started to really enjoy it because it helped me open up more.
Yeah, when you say open up, what do you mean open up more?
I kind of went through this stint where I lost a bit of confidence. But rowing and having that confidence in my physical ability really helped me have more confidence in my social skills. It helped me like reach out to people and be better at talking. And so I made more friends there.
Good for you. And I have an inkling of how hard it is. My daughter did crew in sophomore year, and it was one of the hardest things. It's kind of weird to say two things being true at the same time. She said it was one of the hardest things she ever did, but it was one of the greatest things she ever did. Sounds like you might have a similar experience.
That's exactly right.
Can I ask you what it's like when you're on the river? I've been on the James River, and I've gone swimming in it near Williamsburg. I've been on a boat near Jamestown. I mean, it starts way in the west in the Allegheny Mountains, flows hundreds of miles through Richmond, and then it dumps out in the Chesapeake Bay. When you're on the river, how's it feel? What comes to your mind?
It's this weird kind of, I want to say almost like clearness in my mind. Like when I start rowing on that water, it's almost like everything zeroes out and it's just that rhythm back and forth as I move through the water.
So help me understand a little bit more about how you've changed. What were you like before you took up rowing? And what's the difference now?
Well, before I took up rowing, I was easily overweight by my doctor's standards. I was also closed off. You know, I was always afraid to talk to people, and I wasn't great at team stuff, and I hated physical activity. I dreaded gym. Rowing really helped me change all of that. Now I love sports. I can't help but exercise. And I love talking to people.
And the pandemic's been rough for everybody on the planet, right? I mean, I have teenagers, and when they had to go to school on the computer, that was the worst. They were disconnected from people. We all know people who've gotten sick or worse. Have there been pandemic challenges for you, your family, your friends?
Oh, yeah. I actually had this friend in middle school. Towards the end, he kind of, he broke down a bit. Like, I hung out with him this one time, right? And he burst into tears over how closed off it was in the pandemic. Like, how he couldn't get any of that interaction with people. And he felt alone. And I realized, wow, that's exactly how I feel. And I imagine that's how pretty much everyone feels. That closed off, that lack of togetherness.
Yeah. Well, you know, there have been some government reports where scientists have found a lot of cases where young people have feelings of sadness and hopelessness, especially during COVID-19. Have you seen some of that?
Yeah, definitely. Especially earlier on. That was back when it was virtual, and that was eighth grade. And I remember, like, a lot of my friends were talking about how it sucked to be, like, virtual. You didn't have that same feeling of being around all those people. You think, like, wow, I kind of hate being around all these people sometimes, but then it's gone, and you realize you miss it.
Yeah, no, and for me. And so connect that back to what rowing does. I guess rowing directly or indirectly, I don't know, reconnects you to yourself and reconnects you to people around you outdoors?
Oh, yeah. Rowing is a very introspective kind of sport. So, like, while you do it, you can't focus on anything around you. You have to just zero in on what you're doing as an individual. You know, like, every tiny little motion. And then you got to connect that to everyone else's motion when you're in boats like eights or fours. Your rhythm becomes everyone else's rhythm. And there's just this shared motion and this connection between you and the water and everyone in your boat.
Yeah, and everyone is following. Was it called the stroke seat? That's what my daughter was, the person everyone kind of follows, right?
Yeah, your daughter must have been tall then.
No, she was one of the smallest, but maybe she had good form. But you know what? I feel like you're kind of sitting in the stroke seat for life, for other ninth graders out there. And I just want to ask you, based on what you've learned, what would you tell a 14, 13-year-old who's stuck, closed off from the world, you know, only kind of digitally connected to other people and kind of feeling down?
Well, I tell them to worry less about what other people think and, you know, to really just jump into things no matter what they are. Like, if you see an opportunity, really just go for it.
But it's hard, right? I mean, you can get rejected. You might fail. I mean, some kids won't be as athletic as you. If you go up to other people, they might ignore you. They might laugh at you. It could backfire. No?
You know, that's what most people think, but more often than not, like athleticism, that's something you gain. You know, some people are born with it, but in my opinion, all of the best athletes are the ones who actually have to push themselves for it. And, you know, socially, you got to push yourself too. Like, you can get rejected, but you learn from those and then you grow.
Yeah. I have one last question for you. My colleague Liz, our producer, says you have a classic rock playlist, I believe. Is there one track, is there one song we can play on the way out of this interview?
No, it would have to be Fortunate Son.
Vinosh Pholan, Vin of Chesterfield, Virginia. It's been a great pleasure talking to you and glad you're doing so well. Thank you for the time.
Thanks. Bye.
The Outer Banks in North Carolina is a 200-mile strip of barrier islands, and what happened there this week is another indication of how beach erosion is occurring more quickly and is getting more severe. On Tuesday, two homes on the Outer Banks collapsed into the ocean days after a slow-moving coastal storm. Researchers attribute this increasing erosion to climate change. One way to address the problem is through beach nourishment, which they've been doing on the Outer Banks for decades. That's the process of dredging up sand from the ocean, pumping it on the beach, and spreading it out with heavy machinery. Celeste Gracia of member station WUNC reports on whether beach nourishment is a sustainable solution.
From the second floor porch of Janie Baldy's home in Buxton, North Carolina, you can hear the constant sound of the waves coming up against the beach and see the ocean disappear into the horizon. Baldy and her husband built this house in 1987 and moved here permanently during the pandemic. Their home isn't beachfront. It's a few houses down from the shoreline. Baldy says that gives them a little bit of protection when storms come.
Our street here, which is flooded right now with rainwater, but when we have overwash because of a hurricane or a nor'easter, we just watch the ocean flow right down.
For even more protection, several towns along the Outer Banks are working on beach nourishment projects this summer, including the town of Buxton. The projects are estimated to start this month and end around September and cost about $6 to $18 million. Since the 1930s, there's been nearly 300 beach nourishment projects on North Carolina's coast at a cost of over $700 million. Residents are overwhelmingly in favor of all these projects and the ones to come. Connie Lee James is Baldy's neighbor in Buxton.
I don't know if it's global warming. I assume it is. But we're getting 100-year storms every year and sometimes several times a year. So as the storms got worse and kept coming, I personally was more and more anxious for this to start.
In February, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released a report predicting that sea level along the U.S. coastline will rise 10 to 12 inches in the next 30 years. That's as much sea level rise as the last 100 years. This report also says that higher sea levels will amplify the impacts of coastal erosion.
We know that we have beach erosion, and so how do we mitigate that? And the only tool in North Carolina that's available to do that is beach nourishment.
That's Dare County Manager Bobby Outen. He says that the county plans to continue beach nourishment projects for the foreseeable future. Until 2004, federal funding covered most of the cost of these projects. But now, local communities have to pay for it themselves, or in some cases, like after a hurricane, apply for emergency funding from FEMA. In Dare County, beach nourishment is largely paid for by the visitors who rent out houses or condos.
We have a financial model that's funded by our occupancy taxes on the tourism industry, and that tax is modeled out to make sure that we can continue to maintain the projects that we do. We don't start new projects if we can't afford to take care of the ones that we've already gotten.
Another potential solution to address beach erosion is to build hard structures like jetties, groins, or seawalls. But the North Carolina General Assembly passed a law in 2003 that bans building any of these structures. Western Carolina University geology professor Rob Young says hard structures won't help address beach erosion in North Carolina. He says hard structures are a temporary solution, much like beach nourishment. Barrier islands like the Outer Banks are constantly moving and over long periods of time migrate toward the mainland. Young believes the only sensible long-term solution is managed retreat.
Managed retreat means that instead of spending lots of money and time and resources to try and hold the shoreline in place everywhere, that we find a way in those places where the erosion is the worst and where there are homes that are constantly coming out onto the beach due to erosion, we find a way to move those.
But Dare County Manager Outen says managed retreat is simply not an option.
If you're county commissioner at your house said, hey guys, I'm sorry, but you have to pack up and move out of your house. I mean, that's not a tenable solution. We have to find ways to live with nature and protect the things that we value and mitigate the impacts as best we can.
Which brings us back to beach nourishment. Rob Young agrees that beach nourishment is a practical solution for the Outer Banks for now.
There will come a point in time when it will be incredibly difficult and prohibitively expensive for them to hold that shoreline in place. You know, the question is simply whether that happens 15 years from now or 30 years from now or, you know, who knows.
Residents I spoke to, including Janie Baldy, say they will continue to support beach nourishment efforts despite the cost.
This is my life. This is my home. My children grew up here, basically. They're starting to have children. And, you know, I'm going to die someday. So I would like to know that this is a place where my family can come and carry on and enjoy as we did for so many years.
For Here and Now, I'm Celeste Gracia.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.